You all know why I'm here, not in order. And I would not try to convince you of the worthiness of our cause. I'm a soldier, and we are at war.
We seem to never learn, here we go again. They rallied up the troops, God forgive the sin. Hidden agendas, can't we fight for truth? No, then there be no need to fight. Love isn't fatal, there's no fatalities. Hate supports US principalities. In this separation, we all suffer. We need to be in love with each other. This isn't training, actual invading. Depleted uranium is raining. Iraq, just know we don't have Bush's back. With a vicious attack, crossing borders with might. On foot catching flight, for hypocrisy I will not fight. The Most High loves I, the word won't die. Even after all the times it's been revised. I've been shot by Charlton Heston, and he even autographed the weapon. The bullet was lodged in my left shin. I asked the doctor, and she kept it in.
The stress of waiting for the tension of battle, readying to make war, making peace with their God.
Baptize you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Before their baptism.
You're listening to truthlovefreedom.org. Today is September 24th, 2007. I'm your host, Soul Will. Today's topic is the United Nations. An interview with our special guest, Chris. This is going to be a very interesting interview. I met Chris getting involved with some Ron Paul related stuff. Got it talking to him. The guy knows a lot about the United Nations and various organizations attached to it. Very knowledgeable. And since this podcast is dealing in topics of world government, it seemed only right to have him come on and talk about it. I mean, he knows more than I do, so. And I don't know how good this podcast is going to do, but the last one, the interview with the Freemason, podcast number 8, 743 downloads as of right now as I'm doing this recording. That is more than 7 times my other podcast. Some even more than that. Wow. Got some good feedback and some bad feedback. As always, you can expect that type of thing. It's called an anti-Mason. It's alright. I don't take it to heart. But, I'm hoping to have him back on. I was trying to hook up a little debate between him and the Freemason and another individual who has a site that would be classified as anti-Masonic. And they both have a lot of knowledge, so I thought it would be interesting to have them kind of go head-to-head. The Freemason was game. The other guy wasn't, and it didn't end up developing into anything, so kind of sucks. In the meantime, I've been trying to get a hold of a guy from that made the Zeitgeist movie. Still haven't had any luck getting a hold of him. I've emailed him probably 10 times. And recently I noticed on his website that he cut off email communications because he was getting too many emails. Probably a lot of hate mail as well as love mail. So I guess it's what you can expect when you're doing these types of things, covering these types of topics. But I apologize for my apathetic sound. I'm just really tired, and I wanted to kick one of these out today just because I have the time. And I was really excited to have Chris because I met him, and he was telling me about he's an archaeologist, and he'll talk more about it, but he was telling me about the fact that there's various organizations involved with that he's involved with in his work that is under the dictate of the United Nations. And he seemed to have an in-depth knowledge and personal knowledge about it. He's not just somebody who's talking about it and has an opinion about it that could be, you know, construed as negative. Though he does have an opinion about it, obviously, he has a personal experience with it. So that's always interesting. You know, it's nice to – I like to talk to people who have personal experiences with all this stuff. If you've been paying attention to my blog, I've been doing some changes. I'm going to keep doing them, updating every time I get the chance. But at this rate, it's going to be a very slow process. What else? Let me see. I recently went to the Bohemian Grove. That was quite an experience. I didn't expect anything to happen, honestly. But we ended up getting kind of not chased out because we were already on our way out, but out came a truck from across the way and was kind of driving next to us on our way out, basically telling us to get lost. So that was always fun. Things like that are always fun. I wrote about it on my blog. Feel free to check it out. This is a long interview. Again, my interviews always tend to be pretty long, so I'm going to go ahead and cut this short and just head right into that. I just wanted to invite everybody, though, real quick, that if you have any suggestions for the site, one person suggested to me recently that I should cut off the intro to song to this podcast because it's just kind of, I guess, monotonous. I don't know. To keep playing it, and if you're in agreement, just come to the forum, register, and let me know. I would like to know. I kind of like the idea of having an intro that kind of has to do with this podcast, but you know, this isn't a live show, so obviously I don't want to take up more space on your pod. What do you call them? iPods. So yeah, if you have any suggestions, feel free to let me know. So I'm just gonna go ahead and go into this interview. Okay, so on the line we have Chris. In this podcast, we've been doing a few things on world government and New World Order and the agenda that's unfolding to create that. One major aspect of the New World Order is the United Nations and its effect on our country. A lot of people don't know, but the United Nations has a huge effect on our country. So to talk more about that, talk about his personal experiences involving those types of things, we have Chris.
Hey, Carl.
How's it going?
Good.
Okay, so yeah, I remember talking to you a while back on the phone. You were bringing up some really interesting stuff. Now, could you just kind of state the kind of job that you have so people understand how you came across some of these things involving United Nations laws and whatnot?
Yeah, I graduated from college in 2002 with a degree in anthropology, and I immediately began work as an archaeologist, and I got to travel around the country, work on excavations and surveys, and so I kind of got to get to know the cultural resource laws that our country has, and specifically laws within the state of California. And about a year or two ago, I was invited to a conference by the SAA, which is the Society for American Archaeology. And I went to one of the conference halls, and it was interesting. They were talking about UNESCO and intangible cultural heritage and how they want archaeologists in the United States to basically follow the rules of UNESCO. And so I went and researched it and was basically just astounded at what I found, and basically ever since then I've just been researching it.
So there's so many ways I can go with this. I'm not even sure which one to begin with, because this is really interesting to me, because though I see the agenda unfolding, I hear the verbiage used in the various political speeches from politicians from all over the world, it's rare to have somebody with actual in-depth knowledge about how it's actually unfolding within the government and laws that are allowing it to come to pass. So I don't know really where to go from here. Where do you think would be the best way to go from here?
Well, I usually start out just explaining to people that the United Nations is recognized as a foreign sovereign nation in the U.S. and pretty much just give them an overview of what the U.N. is, because UNESCO is just one branch of the United Nations, and there are many, many branches with many, many acronyms. And it is so confusing to people, they automatically just kind of get turned off to it, because there's hundreds of branches, and within those branches there's, you know, hundreds of other branches with thousands of little leaves that come out. And so I find the easiest thing to do is kind of cut one of those branches off and just, you know, take that route rather than try to explain the whole thing, because it is so confusing, and it's designed to be confusing. Usually when I talk to people about this, I either ask them a question or I just bring it up to them, and usually what I'll say is, you know, how many governments are in the United States? And most people say, well, the U.S. constitutional government. And if a person is particularly enlightened, they might say, or add American Indian tribal sovereignty, which is recognized by our government. But no one I've ever talked to has ever brought up the fact that United Nations is granted full sovereignty as a foreign nation within the United States. And that fact alone oftentimes is kind of very difficult for people to hold on to. They don't understand how that could happen, how that could be.
Yeah, that's interesting. So actually, like when you say it has complete sovereignty within the United States, in other words, it's operating like a nation within our nation? Is that kind of what you're getting at? Or?
Yes, and that is absolutely true. In 1970, our U.S. Congress passed what was called Executive J, and that basically granted United Nations full diplomatic sovereignty as a foreign nation within the United States.
Interesting. Now, when you were at this meeting, I'm just curious because, you know, for me, I'm personally, I want America to keep its sovereignty, and I'm not particularly interested in having the governments of the world merge. I mean, you know, you were in a room full of people listening to this type of stuff. Were you the only one that seemed to have a problem with it?
I would say so. I've also been to other meetings, and they seem to be organized around an agreement called Agenda 21. And that is a UN agreement, and 21 stands for 21st century. And basically what Agenda 21 outlines is sustainable development on a global level. And one of the main frameworks presented in Agenda 21 is to set up these meetings, these conferences, around the world, in the United States, you know, in the counties of all the states, to basically implement the UN's agenda so that the corporations, the local governments, and, you know, everybody else, private nonprofit organizations, are all on board with Agenda 21. Hmm. And that's what I was seeing when I went to these conferences, is they were talking about public-private partnerships. They were talking about having us, private archaeologists, to uphold the UN-UNESCO agreements.
Hmm. That's interesting. So, when you say Agenda 21, what does Agenda 21 exactly mean? You said it's to have you all get behind their agenda book. Like, what exactly do you think their agenda is from your perspective?
Well, like I said before, Agenda 21 is basically a global framework for sustainable development. And sustainable development is a phrase that the United Nations invented. Mm. And I pretty much consider it an oxymoron, because sustainable means to maintain something or to suffer from something. So sustainable development really means to me, you know, prolonged, continued, more development. And when you read Agenda 21, it's basically reading a different language. They oftentimes use words like sustainable, conservation, just referring to previous conventions, previous articles. The big thing about Agenda 21 is that it sets up a framework for public-private partnerships. And that is, you know, something that's very old throughout U.S. history. And an example is, say, the city of San Diego wants to build a highway, but they don't have the funds to build that highway. So what they do is they contract out a private company to build that highway for the city of San Diego. Now that private company is going to make it a toll road so that they can pay for the construction and maintenance of that road.
Really? That's very interesting. That's interesting. So, hold on, let me get my thoughts together here.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's confusing and it's difficult to know like how to approach it and how to go about presenting the information. It's something I've struggled with.
Yeah. So, I guess the way I kind of want to go with this, because there's so many different I'm probably going to have to do another interview with you eventually about various parts of this, and the more I get into this type of stuff, I'm going to probably want to talk to you more about it. But basically, I guess the way I want to go with this is my podcast focuses on agendas and that I believe are dangerous to the people of the society. You know what I'm saying? There's all kinds of agendas unfolding, and I'm not a big fan of agendas that are done in deceptive tactics. Now, you said it was an oxymoronic statement to say that it was
sustainable development.
Yeah, sustainable development. So my question to you is, as you perceive it, you know, do you believe the intentions of all this stuff is really for the best, or do you believe that there is some kind of agenda unfolding that you would think would be dangerous?
I think it's entirely dangerous, and it's incredibly divisive. It undermines everything that the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, you know, Articles of Confederation, all those documents, it undermines.
Right.
Everything.
Because, I mean, here's the thing that I think is really interesting. I think the most interesting thing about it, because, you know, everybody thinks, like I was talking to an old friend of mine, and they said that back in the 60s, they were yelling, eliminate the borders. That was like the big slogan of the 60s. You know, to eliminate the borders and have a global society. And it all seemed really innocent and great because it sounded like, hey, you know, we want peace and this is how we can make it happen. But that's not exactly what's occurring with the United Nations. In fact, it seems like anything the United Nations is involved in is quite the opposite. You know what I'm saying? And even though their agenda is unfolding towards creating this global society, you know, I like to ask people why they think that is. You know, where do they think that's coming from? I mean, they use words like sustainable, and you know, sustainable is really a big word these days with, you know, talk of global warming and creating a culture that's not going to, you know, it's going to be sustainable. In other words, it's not going to hurt the environment. This is not what sustainable means to them, is it?
Sustainable development and just the word in general is pretty much indoctrinated into you know, high school students and the college students. I remember I first heard it when I was in college, and it, you know, it made sense. Like, oh, we need to develop our communities wisely. We need to have planning. But that's just the thing. We don't need sustainable development. We've already had city planning. We've already had, you know, our city governments and county governments regulating these things. Why do we need the United Nations to tell us how to do that?
Right.
But it's interesting when you talk about sort of this introduction of a global government, and if you think about the United Nations and how it started, it's basically relying on confrontation. It was set up because of global war. The League of Nations, which was the predecessor to the United Nations, was set up, you know, out of the Treaty of Versailles, which was signed at the end of World War I. And the U.S. refused to ratify it because it was such a dangerous idea that we would be obligated to enter into a treaty with, you know, all these foreign governments agreeing on the same thing. and that went directly against what, you know, George Washington and a lot of our founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson, you know, those guys, they didn't want us to sign in the treaties with foreign governments.
Hmm.
So after World War II, Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill issued the first Declaration of the United Nations, and they actually referred to the fighting forces of the Allies as the United Nations Fighting Forces, and they provisioned what was known as the Atlantic Charter, which set up the United Nations out of the League of Nations. And in 1945, the U.S. Senate ratified the UN Charter, which effectively recognized the United Nations as, you know, an independent organization, as a diplomatic organization. And then, about a year later, they formed UNESCO. And that's kind of where my research has delved into, because I take a cultural perspective on things, and UNESCO is the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization.
Oh, wow, okay.
And it was created in 1945 by Julian Huxley. Julian Huxley also created the World Conservation Union, which is the IUCN, another acronym. And the IUCN pretty much operates UNESCO. And Julian Huxley even stated that the purpose of UNESCO is to create a world government. It's to eliminate borders. It's to eliminate languages. And to have one language, one border, and one culture. And he actually wrote this in his book entitled UNESCO, Its Purpose and Philosophy. So right there, you clearly have it stated that the purpose of UNESCO is to create a one world government, a one world culture. And so that's why my knowledge as an archaeologist has been important, to kind of look at these things from a cultural perspective and understand that I feel this global government is happening through a kind of a cultural takeover.
So I have my own opinions on why I think certain individuals in this world want world government. On one of my previous podcasts, I was talking to a Freemason, and I believe some of the cultural aspects of this ideology comes from the Enlightenment period and has a huge influence from Freemasonry. And I believe the ultimate goal is a certain utopian society vision. Would you agree with that, or what do you think the ultimate goal? Why push so hard for this world government? What do you think the purpose is?
You know, it's interesting that you brought up utopian, because right now we're in a war on terror. Well, what's the opposite of terror? It's utopia. So are the people who, you know, allegedly were fighting against, you know, the Al-Qaeda, the Islamic fundamentalist extremists, are they on a war against utopia?
Interesting.
And so, what was the question again?
I guess what I was asking is, do you believe the purpose and the agenda, the reason the agenda exists is because there's certain individuals who believe in a utopian society, or what do you believe the purpose is in pushing this, you know, world government?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. I tend not to get so much into the speculative part of things. Basically, from the evidence I've seen and from the research I've done, I tend to think that they want to control they want to control the world's culture as a way to implement the world government. And I don't know what their motivation is. It's obvious to me that they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give you a good example of how Agenda 21 affects U.S. foreign policy and how it affects private organizations within the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
we can look at the Iraq War. And U.S. Congress did not declare war on Iraq. What happened was the U.S. went to the United Nations, and the United Nations passed a resolution authorizing the United States to use its troops to go into Iraq. And so it's essentially the United Nations war. It's not the U.S. war. But an interesting thing happened when the U.S. went into Iraq. They came into Baghdad, and all of a sudden, the Baghdad Museum got looted. And there's some people who speculate that our, you know, U.S. Marines were actually involved in the looting and was protecting the looters, but I haven't seen any proof that would suggest that. So anyways, what happened was people in the U.S. were just so upset that, you know, how could this happen? You know, Iraq's cultural heritage was looted. And so private organizations such as Society for American Archaeology, the Archaeological Institute of America, and several others enacted their duties under Agenda 21, and they petitioned all of their members to sign statements to basically have the U.S. take control of Iraq's cultural heritage. And in 2003, H.R. 2009, that's 2009, passed the U.S. House, was signed by the President, and then about a week later, the United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 1483 called the Cultural Property Implementation Act, and that grants U.S. full rights to take any property in Iraq that they wish, as long as the U.S. feels that that property is in any kind of danger, which has been a total failure when you think about it, because the Iraqi museum was still being looted, and in March of last year, the director of the museum was so fed up with it, he actually capped all the entrances in concrete. So it was a total failure, but yet here we see Agenda 21 being enacted and being successful in passing legislation in the U.S. Congress. And again, I always ask the question, why do we need the United Nations? Why do we need Agenda 21 setting U.S. foreign policy?
I think that's a fair question. Okay, so you started out, you gave us some history on where it came from pretty much already. Is there anything, other aspects about that that you think we should know about?
Yeah, UNESCO has set up a lot of programs around the world that are basically giant land grabs. And in 1972, they had the Convention Concerning the Protection of World Culture and Natural Heritage. And in this convention, they set up what's known as World Heritage Sites and Biosphere Reserve Programs. And this is kind of the origins of the land grab.
Mm-hmm.
And to understand land management, basically, it starts out as, you know, a state park. Then you have a national park, and then you have a national monument. Well, UNESCO has added two more tiers to that. And the next one would be a World Heritage Site. And a World Heritage Site is a property that's recognized for cultural significance, biological significance, or something else. And then the next tier above that is called the Program on Man and Biosphere, MAB, another acronym.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a site that has been recognized for pretty much everything, cultural, biological, ecological, you know, biodiversity.
Okay, so what? Give me an example, what kind of sites would fall under the, and you said it's Man and Biosphere?
Program on Man and Biosphere, and places like that in the U.S., Yellowstone is a Man and Biosphere Reserve.
Huh.
And a World Heritage Site, and this is something I can go into a lot, is Independence Hall in Philadelphia, where Declaration of Independence and U.S. Constitution was signed.
Okay. What the hell do they care about that stuff for? I guess this is what I think that most people would ask you if you heard something like that. Now, you know, if I was somebody who didn't believe there was something sinister going on with these groups, that there was some kind of agenda unfolding that was dangerous, my question to you would be, okay, that sounds like a pretty good cause. Like, there are a lot of places. Like, take, for example, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. You know, that's a historical landmark, and here we are at war there, and they're being destroyed. You know, and wouldn't it be great to have this group whose sole purpose is to go around and basically prevent people from destroying stuff that has historical significance? So what exactly is, I mean, I guess my question is what's the purpose behind that? I mean, it seems pretty, like a pretty good idea.
And I hear that a lot. A lot of people I talk to about this, fellow archaeologists, either they think I'm crazy and they think I'm a conspiracy theorist, or they pretty much think, oh, that sounds good. I'd rather have the UN, you know, in running, managing these sites. But the purpose of these World Heritage Sites and these biosphere reserves is that they're recognized globally as significant, and their goal is to preserve these sites for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And my first rebuttal to that is nothing lasts forever.
Mm-hmm.
And an interesting thing is, once a site has been declared a World Heritage Site or a Biosphere Reserve, automatically it gets increased tourism. And
really?
When you have more people going to these sites, they automatically begin to be degraded. People, you know, they vandalize, they, you know, leave their garbage. And in fact, the Great Pyramid in Giza, which is a World Heritage Site, they had to close off tours to the inside of the pyramid because so many people were going through, they were changing the humidity inside the pyramid, which was affecting the you know, preservation elements.
Interesting.
And most recently, Machu Picchu in Peru, which is this amazing, you know, Inca site that's up in the highlands, they shut it down to human use because so many tourists were going there, and it's, you know, listed on World Heritage. So many people were going there that it was starting to, you know, adversely affect the site.
Mm-hmm.
So when people argue that, you know, on the surface that this is a good thing, it's meant for preservation, well, no. Actually, it leads to further degradation, and it also leads to shutting off the site completely to human activity.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people out there who, you know, think that's a good idea, that these sites should be restricted.
Mm-hmm.
But the key element to remember is it's not the sovereign governments of these countries that are making these decisions. It's the United Nations.
So does the United Nations basically impose its will upon countries that don't necessarily, like, they're more, I guess, they haven't really signed up, I guess you could say, with the United Nations as far as, like, you know, giving them, you know, sovereignty like the U.S. does in their country? I mean, there are countries like that, I'm assuming.
Yeah, there are countries that aren't signed up to either, you know, the United Nations or UNESCO.
Mm-hmm. Because my first thing that comes to mind with that whole thing you were talking about is, like, you know, if there's a monument in the United States, I think the United States has plenty of societies and organizations that can deal with that. We don't necessarily need the United Nations to have anything to do with it. Like, what, you know, I guess my question, I mean, I could see, like, places where, you know, you have, like, religious beliefs and, you know, was it Saddam Hussein that was bombing those Buddhist caves,
yeah,
and stuff like that?
Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden was bombing the Buddhist temples, right?
Right. You know, that kind of sucked. And I could see the United Nations jumping on that because that nation at the moment wasn't going to do anything about it because it was being ran by them. I guess what I would say is, you know, I mean, the United States doesn't need something like that. Why do you think that the United States would hand that kind of authority over to a global government? You know, the United Nations, what would be the purpose of that?
Well, like you said, on the surface, it sounds like a really good thing. I mean, we have a site here, you know, let's take Independence Hall, for example. You know, this is the birthplace of U.S. freedom, essentially. You know, what a great thing it would be to have this site recognized worldwide as, you know, the birthplace of, you know, freedom, that ideology that, you know, all men are created equal and we all have the right to life, liberty, and happiness. Mm-hmm. But it's conversely, it's sort of just the fact that it is a World Heritage Site goes directly against the whole foundation of what the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution is based on. Mm-hmm. Because in 1996, Bill Clinton signed Executive Order 12,986. And that order gives the IUCN, which is the World Conservation Union, which runs UNESCO, which operates the World Heritage Sites, that executive order gave the IUCN full diplomatic amnesty and granted IUCN as a sovereign entity. So that means that that World Heritage Site, that place, that Independence Hall, is sovereign UN territory. Now, I can't think of a bigger slap in the face to U.S. cultural heritage than to make the property, which was the foundation, which was the birthplace for its independence and for its, you know, Bill of Rights and all these freedoms, to have it being taken over by an organization which in no way, shape, or form, you know, emulates, a constitutional republic. And so it's a direct threat to U.S. cultural heritage. But here the U.N. is saying, we're preserving this cultural heritage. So on the surface, it looks good, but then you read the legislation, and it goes completely contradictory to what they're telling everybody.
Yeah. And you know what concerns me about that, and this is just my personal thing, I've said this on my podcast and previous podcasts, is, you know, this notion of a united world government drives me nuts because it seems so blatantly reckless. And it's reckless in the sense that you give that much power to a central authority, and the wrong group or person comes into that and gains that authority, and we're going to have a really messy situation in this world, you know, where somebody comes in and believes that America is the bane of his existence and he wants to see things like that destroyed, he would have the authority to do that. Or, you know, it really bothers me. It just seems kind of absurd. I wouldn't expect, right. You know, I wouldn't give a Buddhist monastery that has historical significance to a right-wing Christian group, because I wouldn't expect that they would want to take care of it. You know, they have no interest in it. You know what I'm saying?
Well, look at the organization of the UN, okay? You have the Secretary General, which is the president of the UN. And that person is appointed in secret by the UN Security Council. So there's no diplomatic process there. And the United Nations Security Council is elected by the General Assembly of the United Nations, which includes all the members from all the states. And the members of the General Assembly are not elected by the government. They're appointed by the president, prime ministers of their respective governments. So here we have the entire operational structure of the UN isn't based on any sort of democratic, you know, legislation. It's, like I said before, it no way represents the structure of a constitutional republic. Wow. Basically, like you said, you could have someone who's in there who is not there to do good. And government is, you know, a great example of people throughout history having ill intentions. So if that happens, which it is very likely could and is happening, it's a very bad thing, because the people of the United States, the people of these other sovereign countries, have no democratic way of getting those UN representatives out of office.
So you came across this through your work, and now I'm imagining there's many tentacles on this beast. You mentioned the land grab. Can you explain to me the purpose of the land grab? Is it just basically sites like that, or is there other things?
Well, first of all, let's look at the Constitution. And Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution says that any needful changes, rules, regulations about U.S. property, U.S., you know, public lands, is invested in Congress. Congress is the only entity that has the authority to make any regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have the UN UNESCO coming in and saying, no, we passed, you know, we have this executive order that says this is our sovereign territory and we have the right to make decisions. We have the right to, you know, manage this land.
Now, this is a pretty fascinating topic. There's many, many aspects to this that I've read about. You know, I was just recently talking about the North American Union deal and how, you know, there's the agenda to merge Canada, Mexico, and the United States. Now, the European Union is similar to that. Do you believe there was some UN influence there?
Absolutely, no doubt about it. It is, I believe that the North American Union, the European Union, the Asian Union, African, it's all being basically set out by the UN through Agenda 21.
Uh-huh.
And you look at, you know, one of the big issues that's come up with this North American Union is the NAFTA highway.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take a look at that, that, you know, is obviously a public-private partnership. Except the only difference is the private part has nothing to do with the U.S. You have a foreign company, Cintra, who is building a road in the United States, a NAFTA highway, with through the cooperation of the government.
Hmm.
And without going into any details about the company that I work for, but there's a lot of people out there who say that this highway doesn't exist. They're not building a NAFTA superhighway. Well, the company I work for actually has the contract to do the archaeological history evaluation for the Trans-Texas Corridor, for the segment that runs from Mexico to Oklahoma.
Oh, my God. So, okay, so that's opening up a can of worms right there. So they actually have the contract. So where do they get the? I mean, obviously, there's probably a lot of other contracts being dealt through various companies and organizations for the purpose of getting this thing accomplished, because it's no small feat.
Right.
I just don't understand where they get off saying that such a thing does like that doesn't exist. I mean, they even have a map drawn out of the damn thing. Is that, am I wrong?
Well, that's true. I mean, you can go to the company that. I guess it's an organization, a conglomeration of people called NASCO. You can actually go to their website, and right there on their website, it says it's a NAFTA highway. They deny the fact that it's a superhighway, but they admit that it is a NAFTA highway. And NAFTA was drafted by the World Bank. It was drafted by the United Nations, and is pretty much implemented through the WTO, the World Trade Organization, which, again, it goes right back to the World Bank, to the United Nations. And toll these, you know, private companies, you know, through these public-private partnerships constructing these toll roads is nothing new. It's, like I mentioned before, in San Diego, you know, installing this private company, installing a toll road on the city's behalf. It's a merger of private corporations, local governments, and it doesn't matter where that private corporation is coming from, what their motivations are. If the government has something they want to get done, they'll take the money, they'll give the contract to whoever is willing to get it done.
Hmm. So excuse my ignorance, but what exactly is a toll road? I'm not even sure what that is. Now, you said it, basically the toll roads are how they pay for it when it's done by private companies. Is that correct?
Yeah. And, you know, there are toll roads that are government run.
Right. Like, you know, like when you go across the bridge in San Francisco, that's like a government thing, right? Like they pay when you get through it. So basically a toll road is, in order to use it, you have to pay.
Right. If you want to drive, you got to pay a toll. And there are hundreds of toll roads in California alone, and they're building more. And the thing that's interesting about the North American Union, or, you know, this NAFTA superhighway in Texas, is that the state of Texas Department of Transportation is actually handing over state highway to Centra.
So they can own it.
They're handing that highway over, and Centra is basically improving it and turning it into a toll road.
Really?
Sort of on another interesting tangent to that, the legal firm that's representing Centra, that's doing all the paperwork and, you know, jumping through all the governmental hoops, getting this pushed through, you know, the Texas legislature, is Brackwell and Giuliani, which is Rudolph Giuliani's legal firm, or he is a partner in that legal firm. So here we have a presidential candidate of the United States, right, supposedly acting in our best interest, who's making $11 million a year off of a company that's a foreign company that's, you know, making toll roads. That's taking up our public highways.
You know, I mean, to be completely honest, this pisses me off. There's a lot of ways this just does not seem right to me. I mean, I'm just imagining it, you know, the someday in the future, you know, somebody who, I mean, I'm not a rich person. I'm doing a lot better off than I've done in the past. But I remember there was a time where I wanted to go into San Francisco. I literally didn't have the money to go across the bridge. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, this literally restricts people from movement. It doesn't help the situation at all.
That's part of Agenda 21, is to basically create open spaces which are restricted from any human use and keep people in urban cities and suburbia. And that's the plan, is to restrict our movement to keep us in the cities. And that is the basis of sustainable development.
That's like a city that's a prison. You know, if their intent is to keep us locked into small spaces, so what? What are they going to do with the rest of the area that no one's allowed to go into? You know, what's the purpose?
Well, part of Agenda 21 deals with population, and it's no secret that the UN wants to reduce the population. In fact, they're really happy that the U.S. has a negative population growth. And one of the things that is stated in Agenda 21 is basically to eliminate poverty. And they want to eliminate poverty by empowering women to, you know, grant them reproductive rights. Well, the reproductive rights is defined as abortion. So basically, they want to eliminate poverty by getting rid of all the poor people, by not having them reproduce. And that goes back to the poor laws were in England, where the monarchs didn't want people to breed. They didn't want poor people to breed. And it's an effective way of just cutting out the people that they see unworthy, sort of the social Darwinistic mentality to evolve human beings. And if they're going to cluster us all in these huge urban cities, then there has to be a way to reduce the population, and that's one of the things that's set out in Agenda 21.
This is all very fascinating. Like, you know, I've done research on United Nations. I haven't gone into these depths. I you know, it's obvious, it's right on the surface level. You can see the agendas. You know what I'm saying? They're pretty obvious, you know, the different groups.
Yeah.
And I've never gone into, like, how it's all unfolding and how the network exists within all the different organizations. It's pretty outrageous. I mean, it's not only, like, in a direct contradiction to what United States stands for, but it's, like, almost completely opposed to it in the sense that I don't see how the United States can coexist with an organization that's agendas and intentions are directly opposite of what we perceive as freedom. You know, it just...
Well, that's why in the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan was president, he actually got us out of UNESCO. He actually said that this organization is really corrupt. They don't represent what you know, our country is about. And he got us out of UNESCO. And when Bill Clinton came into office, he started signing all these executive orders, like 12,986, which, you know, gives the IUCN diplomatic amnesty and sovereignty. And he also signed Executive Order 13,083, 13,132, which transfers power from the Congress to the executive in the state of emergency. And also, he signed an executive order that set up a federal agency to work with the UN so that the UN has full regulation of U.S. policy in case of a natural disaster. And so he did all this without being a member of UNESCO. And then George Bush, George Jr., comes along, signs a backup to UNESCO, and starts signing all his executive orders, like the Preserve America Act, which says that all our state, federal, and national monuments and parks, we are now going to integrate UN policies with all these parks. So you have this clear sign of, you know, these politicians aren't Democrats, they aren't Republicans, they're United Nations. They're working for the United Nations.
Globalists.
Yeah, they all have the same agenda, and I think that it's culminating towards, you know, a North American Union, which is going to end up in a world government, a world union.
Wow. So, I just, when you hear that this stuff is happening, I just go, you know, how is it possible that we came from a place in our country where such an idea would have just been rejected from the get-go to a place where it's just almost, it's going so quickly, it seems like, you know, like, I mean, if I remember correctly, it was, you know, when I started getting into this idea of a world government, I started reading about it in various books. It was, you know, the European Union was coming along, and I was thinking, wow, we're a long way away from the United States being merged. And then here we are seeing all this other stuff happening with the secret meetings. And it's just, it's going so quickly now. And it just, it trips me out because it makes me wonder, like, you know, what kind of history does the United Nations have? I mean, you said it started after World War II. Is that right?
Yeah, it actually started out before World War II. It started out after World War I with the signing of the Treaty of Versailles in 1918 when the League of Nations was created. But it kind of goes back even further than that. And it goes back to a guy named Cecil Rhodes, who was this, you know, British tycoon. The guy was insanely wealthy.
Right, that's the root of the Rhodes Scholars, right?
And, yeah.
Yeah.
So, when Cecil Rhodes died, he left his will behind. And if I can, I'll just read a section of his will that I have.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
So, these are exact words from his will. To and for the establishment, promotion, and development of a secret society, the true aim and object whereof shall be for the extension of British rule throughout the world, the perfecting of a system of immigration from the United Kingdom and of colonization by British subjects of all lands where the means of livelihood are attainable by energy, labor, and enterprise, and especially the occupation by British settlers of the entire continent of Africa, the Holy Land, the Valley of Euphrates, the islands of Cyprus and Canada, the whole of South America, the islands of the Pacific, not heretofore possessed by Great Britain, the whole of the Archipelago, the seaboard of China and Japan, the ultimate recovery of the United States of America as an integral part of the British Empire. And it goes on. And it basically says that we need to create a system where the United Kingdom takes over the world. And one of the things that was created out of the will of Cecil Rhodes was the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations. And that was founded in 1921, shortly after the League of Nations. And so here we have Cecil Rhodes saying that we need to create a secret society that will take over these countries in the world, but especially the United States. And so through his trust in his, you know, from his money that he accumulated over his life, founds the CFR. And they've created basically U.S. foreign policy since 1921. But other agencies that have come out of the CFR are the Nature Conservancy, National Wildlife, Greenpeace, Sierra Club. And these are all organizations who are advocating the United Nations take over lands across the world. And there's even a program called Debt for Nature Swap. And it's actually a U.S. law that says if a country, say, like Guatemala, has an outstanding debt to the United States, the U.S. can go in and say, we'll forgive a percentage of this debt if you give us this, you know, 10 square miles of land. And what they'll do is the U.S. will forgive their debt, Guatemala will hand their land over, and it'll be managed by a group like the Sierra Club or Nature Conservancy, who are working as non-governmental organizations for the United Nations. And then you have all the policies of NAFTA, World Trade Organization, which are drafted by CFR.
This is actually, I'm pretty outraged right now. Like, that's a lot of connections to a lot of organizations that I had no idea were any way remotely related to the United Nations. You know, I understood the Council on Foreign Relations. I did not know it came from the United Nations, and or it had any relation to, I mean, it's not from the United Nations, but it has a link through Cecil Rhodes.
Yeah. Well, yes, the trust of Cecil Rhodes established CFR. And the CFR established all these private nonprofit organizations. These nonprofit organizations are non-governmental organizations known as NGOs, which are members of the United Nations. And these NGOs, like Sierra Club, Greenpeace, so forth, they actually are entrusted with land from these debt for nature swaps. And these swaps occur all the time. In fact, I use the example of Guatemala because that just happened a few months ago. And so here you have another way where the UN is kind of reaching its hand out through these organizations to grab land.
I mean, you're dealing with the very essence of a United States foreign policy and foreign policy throughout the world. And they're all gravitating towards centralization through the United Nations. Do you think when the global government comes, it's going to be the United Nations? I mean, do you think the structure is already set up there that could, you know, can govern a whole world?
That tends to be the direction I lean in. I can't say for certain, but to me it seems like the United Nations is going to be that world government. And like I said, I don't like to get into like the speculation, a lot of the conspiracies around things. But one of the things that I've noticed in my research is a lot of the symbology of things. And if you look at the emblem of the United Nations, you clearly see the globe, the Earth, and it's surrounded by this grid. Or I look at it as a net. I see the world caught in a net. And surrounded by that net is olive branches. And traditionally, the olive branch is known as a sign of peace. But if you really look at it, the olive branch is actually known as a sign of submission. And throughout history, in Greek times and Roman times, when they would go out and they'd conquer a new land, they'd conquer the foreigners, the barbarians, they would have them wear olive branches as a sign of their submission to show that they were peaceful, that they weren't going to, you know, revolt. So So here we have the United Nations symbol, the earth caught in a net, surrounded by a firmament of submission. And there's all kinds of other symbology that goes into the other, you know, UN programs, like UNESCO symbol is the Greek Parthenon, and the Parthenon was the building that the tyrant Greek states paid tribute to in, you know, for protection.
Hmm.
So here we have these countries around the world who donate money to UNESCO. UNESCO offers to protect their cultural heritage, but they're really taking it over. And I can go on with those kinds of examples of symbolism.
Oh, wow. You know, one of the next people I was going to get into, I was actually planning on doing it with this podcast, but I didn't really feel like doing some reading, is this guy's Zbigniew Brzezinski. And
yes.
His book, The Grand Chessboard, which is really interesting because it basically lays out the entire purpose and reasoning for going into the Middle East, which if you really get to the root of what he's saying, it's to basically take control of its natural resources for the coming conflict he saw between Russia and China, unless they were willing to come into the United Nations fold in a way, I guess. I don't know to what extent, he didn't really specify, but it sounded really interesting. And I decided to get his other book, and his other book is called Between Two Ages, which is more of his own personal philosophic and kind of cultural ideologies. In one point of it, it talks about the uniting of the world into a world government, and he goes into the necessity of it. And his now the funny thing about him is that he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a founder of the Trilateral Commission.
Right.
You know, co-founder of the Trilateral Commission. And a lot of the same, theories about, you know, the purpose and this stuff, it's pretty overwhelming. You know, just hearing you bring all the connections together, if you were to draw like a grid kind of connecting all these different groups through the various people and with quotes, I mean, it's almost an undeniable. I wouldn't say almost. It's completely undeniable. You'd have to be pretty much a lunatic to believe that it's not happening. But yet, you know, whenever I see them in interviews and people hit them up about it, they always deny it as if, like, it's even asinine that they're asked, you know, that something like this could be occurring. It just blows my mind that they can even deny it.
That's one of the things that makes me angry, too, is that it's not necessarily that they're doing it. I mean, to be honest with you, I can imagine a world that, you know, has a world government. I do believe in, you know, sovereignty of nations, but I can kind of see a world government or a necessity for a world government. The problem that I have is that the secretiveness about it, the divisiveness about it, how they go about things, you know, they say, oh, this isn't happening, when it really is. And that's one of the interesting things about UNESCO is that when they first came up with the World Heritage Program and the Man on Biosphere Program in the 1970s, they told everybody that this was going to be a limited program, and they were only going to, you know, nominate sites that were, you know, really, really significant, because people were afraid that it was a land grab, and they told them no.
You know, that's funny, because that's exactly what's happening with the North American Union thing, the Security and Prosperity Partnership. They're saying the exact same thing.
Exactly. They're saying, no, this isn't a NAFTA superhighway. This isn't a merger of, you know, Mexico, Canada, and United States. But you go read the CFR document, which is, I believe, called Building a North American Community, and you read that document, and it states right out in the open that this is about creating a partnership with Mexico, Canada, and the United States with no borders, that they want to protect the southern border of Mexico. And, you know, if there was a border north of Canada, they would want to protect that too. And they're telling people that, no, this isn't happening. This, you know, you're a bunch of kooks, a bunch of conspiracy theorists, but you can go to the NASCO website, and it says plain as day that this is a NAFTA highway. And they've got a map of it. And you can see how they're building what's, you know, the inland ports, which are these various cities that they've selected throughout the three countries where are going to be their hubs for distributing all the merchandise that comes through this highway.
And just to bring up, this is kind of unrelated, well, it's semi-related, is the way they're going to get access to the superhighway is through eminent domain. Is that right?
Oh, that's a very excellent thing you brought up right there, because I actually wanted to bring this up, is you have, like, this formulation of the public-private partnership, and the eminent domain thing is completely a public-private partnership. And I think it was the 2005 ruling where the Supreme Court said that, you know, private sector, private corporations have eminent domain. And when you think about that, it's a public-private partnership. A private corporation can go to basically anywhere. They can go to your house, my house. They can go to a retirement community or a city, or maybe not a city park, but choose any land that they want and say, the tax revenue that we will generate by developing this land is beneficial to the government. So you have private industry saying that we will benefit the public sector by gaining control of this land, and the Supreme Court says, okay, that's completely constitutional, even though it, you know, violates some gray area in the Fifth Amendment, which says that, you know, government has to give you compensation for your land, and it can only be used for public purposes.
And the scariest thing about that, at least in my perspective, is that now what essentially is what is happening there is they're granting government power to private corporations. I mean, so I just kind of already have a bad feeling about eminent domain in general. Now, the notion that not only the city being able to do that, but that some company could come along and say, you know, come up with some excuse about it being in the best interest and literally take your property from you, to me, is an absurdity. It's just, it's so outrageous that it could happen. It just blows my mind.
Well, it's really an issue that, when you tell people about, they don't get it. Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, whatever. Everyone disagrees with it. No one can figure out how it is the Supreme Court made a ruling 5-4 for granting the private sector eminent domain. It makes no sense to anybody. But then you have to think, why did this happen? And again, you look back to Agenda 21, creating public-private partnerships.
Wow.
You have private corporations taking over people's private land to generate tax revenue for the public or the government. Hmm. And it's an easy way to basically buy people off. Think about who these corporations that are taking over these properties, who are they donating money to? Are they donating money to Republicans, to Democrats? We don't know.
Yeah. Wow. So, I mean, we're kind of all over the place. We haven't really done a linear history. We talked about some aspects of the where it comes from, some of what, you know, people perceive it to be, and what it really is. A little bit of its history, it's kind of its growth, I guess. It just kind of branches out. It started with, you know, like you said, the League of Nations, and then turned into the United Nations, and then all these different groups came out of it, and so on and so forth. We talked about some of the U.S. government's involvement in it and how it's affecting our country. Is there any other aspects of this that's affecting the United States in a way that should be mentioned?
Well, like I said, I always look at things from a cultural perspective, and that's kind of how I've done my research. And there's some things that aren't necessarily bad, but when you take a closer look at them, they're really reinforcing what the UN is doing. And one of the examples that I'm going to use, just because it's something that I think a lot of people can understand, is the movie The 300. Okay, I'm sure you've seen it.
Actually, I haven't. Should I? Pretty good movie.
It's up to you. A lot of people love the movie, and I'm not going to knock them for that. Myself, having a lot of knowledge about that period of time and what actually happened, I thought it was a horrible movie. And I recognize it as total propaganda. And without going into details of history, basically they totally bastardized Spartan history, or, you know, Greek history. And it was really kind of depressing for me to watch. But what came out of that was the Iranian government, or an organization within the government, protested the movie. They went to UNESCO with a letter of protest and said, "You guys, you need to do something about this. We're gonna boycott the movie. We're gonna protest it worldwide. And what are you gonna do about it?" And UNESCO came out and said, "We will maintain our duties as an educational, scientific, and cultural organization." And they didn't really say, you know, "Yes, we're going to support you," or "No, we're not." But what they did was they reinforced the fact that there is a UNESCO charter and that it does have authority and it does have power.
Huh.
So even though nothing came out of it, we still have that sort of justification for UNESCO. And
yeah,
on a side note, the movie is total propaganda. There's several references in the movie to U.S. Marines, not directly, but in an interview with the director, he basically said that, yes, this movie was made to pay homage to U.S. Marines. And look at where we are in the world right now, and look at who we're probably going to go after next is Iran.
Yeah, that's going to be one of my next big topics that I'm going to hit on is, you know, the coming war with Iran, because it, you know, every day in the news now, headlines, just like Iraq, you know, weapons of mass destruction. Now the big slogan is they're supplying, you know, Iraq, you know, insurgents with weapons, you know. It's like,
well, right. They started saying that the Iranians were supplying the Iraqi insurgents with the, you know, the improvised explosive devices, the IEDs. Well, that didn't stick, right? Even the Iraqi, you know, prime minister or whoever he is came out and said that's not true. And our government got all mad. So now they're saying, oh, Iran is providing missiles to the insurgents. It's just... they're going to keep
Been firing any missiles. I mean, I've been following the news, and I know people are strapping bombs to their body and blowing themselves up, but have you heard of any missiles?
No.
I mean, they're not firing missiles that I'm aware of. I mean, I just don't know. I don't know. Maybe in a few days we'll see, headline news: Iran missile, you know, bombs a local town. I don't know.
Well, an interesting thing to kind of correlate Iran with the United Nations is that Iran is actually very cooperative with the United Nations. And they have, you know, I know there's a lot of headlines in the U.S. that they refuse to let the inspectors in. Well, actually, they did let the inspectors in. The inspectors were in their country for, like, I think 15 years before this whole, you know, debauchery in Iraq started. And the Iranians basically said, that's enough. You guys have been here for a decade now. You haven't found anything. Get out. And so the UN did. And Iran has been very cooperative with the United Nations. In fact, they've been nominating a lot of their properties for World Heritage status. They've been nominating more than any of the other countries right now. And I can't figure out why they're doing that. But for some reason, they're really being lapdogs to the UN.
Interesting. So, Do you think the United Nations and Agenda 21 has anything to do with why, you know, our current administration is so gung-ho about taking over the Middle East?
Yeah, I do. I think that the UN is entirely invested in war. In fact, I mean, you look at their whole origins, it's based on war. The League of Nations came out of World War I. The UN came out of World War II. If you know, the world is at peace, there's no reason to have world government, because we're all happy, we all have our sovereignty, we all have our, you know, theoretical utopia. And that's not to say there's not going to be crime, there's not going to be murders or conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But if the world is at peace, there's no necessity for a world government to come in and basically regulate. But if there is conflict, if there is war like there is now, that's the whole incentive for countries to unite under one banner. And that's completely irrelevant throughout history.
Mm.
You look at, you know, I always use the example of Greece, because, you know, during the Peloponnesian War, when Iran was, you know, attacking the Greek states, they all united.
You know what? I just think that you covered so much on your own here. Like, I could ask you a number of questions, and you're just going to go back over the same stuff, probably. I mean, it's a huge topic. I think that it's important for everybody to do as much research as possible about it, just to be aware of what direction our country is going in. And I have my own theories. I always say I have my own perspectives and theories about where this is all going, but, you know, the point of the podcast is mostly information, to just give people information and let them make decisions on their own. But you definitely supplied me and them with a lot of information to think about and to and perhaps good framework to begin investigation.
Well, researching Agenda 21 is pretty difficult, mainly because the thing is like 1,000 pages long. And like I said, if you don't understand the language, you're not going to understand what they're talking about.
Mm.
When they, you know, like I mentioned before, like when they refer to the reproductive rights of women, well, if you go to the convention that they reference for that, that reproductive rights for women is defined as abortion. So there's all these kinds of little hidden definitions behind the words that aren't transparent. And The other thing about Agenda 21 is every 5 years they have a new conference. And that's another 1,000 pages to read through. So it's pretty tedious and confusing, and it's designed to be confusing. It's designed in a way as such that it's not palatable for people to understand. And It takes me a long time to figure it out. And Every time I reread it, I pull something new about it, because I start to understand their language more.
Yeah. So I know I asked you once before, but I'm going to go ahead and ask you again. Are you willing to contribute to the blog as far as, like, you know, doing small articles about various, you know, individual parts of all this and how it's affecting you at the U.S. government and our sovereignty?
Yeah, I'm willing to do that. Awesome. If anybody wants to learn more about what I've been talking about, I wrote a short paper about it on my website.
Which is
Circus and Bread.
Right, and I have that link on our site, circusandbread.com.
Yeah, and if they go to that website and there's a sidebar and there's a tab called UN Land Grab, and that pretty much goes into more detail about stuff we talk about in a much more organized fashion.
Awesome. Now, just for the sake of bringing it up, because I know I heard you talking about it once before, could you explain the title of your website, circusandbread.com?
Yeah, that goes back to the Roman era. And what happened was people were starting to get really upset because the Roman Empire had expanded so much, so fast, that it was kind of starting to crumble. And there was all these sort of chinks in the armor, I guess, and people were upset. They started protesting. They started revolting. And so I believe the emperor at the time was Caligula, and he instituted the bread and circus. And what he'd do was he'd have the gladiator games, which is places where they'd basically have this flesh fair of carnage and killing and you know, real kind of gruesome stuff. And they'd give out free bread. And one of the things that happened was people became happy. They were getting really incredible entertainment, and they were getting free food.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of the origins of the name of my website is, you know, the circus and bread, sort of the inverse of the bread and circus. This is, you know, this is stuff that is being covered up by the media or not being addressed by the media. It's a departure from the mindless entertainment, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting because it reminds me of, like, you know, kind of society today. It's like, you know, just television and, you know, entertainment and food. It's kind of, you know, well, I think there was a quote I remember reading from some guy in a book. I don't remember what it was, but he basically said it, until America is no longer fat and entertained, they'll never do anything to create positive change.
It's very true, and it's so disturbing. And I just noticed this past week, I don't normally watch TV, but I was staying outside of my house with someone who had a TV, so I was watching these news shows, and just the insane amount of depth they go into about O.J. Simpson. Like, O.J. Simpson walks down the street, and they start talking, you know, all these conspiracy theories and ideas and possibilities, and I started thinking, they'll discuss all these conspiracy theories openly about O.J. Simpson. They'll go into every last, you know, perverted detail about, you know, his wife being murdered and all these things, but they will not take seriously one moment a North American union. They will not take seriously one moment the idea that, you know, the UN has control over U.S. sovereign territory. They won't address, you know, all the other issues that come around, like the Federal Reserve and
It's funny because whenever these topics come up, they just smack them down right from the get-go. It's so blatantly obvious that they have something invested in some kind of, you know, I mean, there's obviously pressures going on that's preventing them from talking about it, or they would give it more time, you know, and they just don't. They don't even bother, like, trying to, you know, do a rebuttal to any claims about it. They just don't talk about it.
You know, that's what's interesting. Even when they do bring something up, because the public is basically forcing them to bring it up, and the North American Union is one of those topics right now,
mm-hmm.
and you'll hear them being forced to address it, and they'll talk about it, but they'll always have another person on the show, like a, you know, a co-producer or a guest, you know, saying, you're a kook if you think there's a North American Union.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they always have that voice of doubt, that voice of contradiction, that if you think these things, then you're crazy.
Right. I think, sorry, go ahead.
Well, that's the thing that bothers me the most, is because it's so dismissive to call someone crazy, to call them a nut job. You're basically throwing their argument out the window, you know, whereas if it's less damaging to a society, to the government, to just address these things openly. I mean, look at what's happened with 9/11. You look at the conspiracy theories that have formed because the government refuses to address the issue.
Mm-hmm.
If they were to address that, they could put a lot of that to rest, but they don't.
Right.
So what happens? The conspiracies fuel. Things get crazy. You know, literally, there's 9/11 things that are crazy. You know? And there's also a lot of things that are absolute fact.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can lump everything into one and say, you know, you're a nutbag because
mm-hmm.
you believe that, you know, if the U.S. would have enforced its immigration policy, you could have prevented 9/11 because some of the hijackers were in the country illegally, you get lumped in with, you know, holograms hit the towers or whatever, you get, you know.
Oh, yeah. Or like, or that it never happened. I actually listened to a guy on, I think it was a podcast or something. He literally said that there were never planes at all.
Right.
They were bombs. I'm like, wow, you know, that must have been one hell of a hologram. You know, it's almost like it's so absolutely absurd to me, because it seems to me that it would make a lot more sense to just go ahead and hit it with freaking planes. Like, why would you? What's up with the holograms theory?
If they can keep running, the media and the government can keep running interference and not addressing the issue, not giving it any credence, any airtime at all, people are going to start coming up with this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what they want, because it continues sort of the, you know, the dumbing down, the disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, personally, I think, in history, shows that that's the worst thing a government can do, is not address a conspiracy theory.
Indeed.
I mean, look at what's happened with you know, Roswell, New Mexico. You know, look at what's happened with JFK.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been validated in any way, but it's produced a whole industry that makes money.
Right.
And you're starting to see that now with 9/11. All these people coming out with all these videos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all you know, the memorabilia, that kind of stuff, and even the Hollywood movies that have come out recently. You know, Fahrenheit 9/11 grossed like $250 million worldwide.
And yeah.
What came out of that? Nothing at all.
Yeah.
No resolve came out of that movie.
Yeah. Michael Moore got rich. Richer.
Richer. He was already rich.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's interesting. It's that whole, you know, it's that if people, when our government doesn't address things, it's the lack of interest in the fact that they don't even try to form a rebuttal to any claims made that fuels, you know, the movement, because to them that shows that they have something to hide. You know, it almost validates every theory about it. Any theory they're unwilling to, you know, do a rebuttal on is evidence that they are, that it's true. And it's I see what you're saying. It's a totally,
well, that's what I mean. It's so damaging because they're not addressing it. There's facts about 9/11 that we can prove, and there's issues that we can't prove. But the government isn't addressing any of them.
Yeah.
Even though we can prove these things, the government won't address it, so that just damages them even more.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes no sense for them. Why, you know, why wouldn't the Pentagon release, you know, some of the videotapes? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff that's a real kicker for me.
The conspiracy theories.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to get into 9/11 on a future podcast for sure. Actually, I'm probably going to do it. Dedicate 3 or 4 podcasts to it, because it's such a significant issue in conspiracy circles. I typically don't share my opinion about it, because my opinion doesn't matter. Like, I share my worldview on certain aspects, but when it comes to things like that, it's just, you know, we'll just let the evidence speak for itself and see what happens. I just like to be an extra source for people to get information that, or I'm not trying to push, you know, a certain belief, you know.
That's the position I come from. It's kind of the view of an investigator. Let's look at what's provable, and let's look at what's not provable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's this thin line of, okay, that could have happened, but it's speculation. Well, if you can't, you know, disprove that it happened, then it's, did it happen or not? So,
yeah.
And I think 9/11 is like a great mental exercise for people, because you have what's put out by the government, you have what's fact, what's known fact and true that the government does address, and then you have sort of the propaganda that's put out by people on the internet,
mm-hmm.
you know, the other extreme.
Exactly.
It's really interesting to look at it, and it's a great mental exercise, because you can look at the propaganda on the internet and the propaganda for the government, and, you know, basically look at the facts and get your own decision.
Okay, Chris, well, thank you for sharing all the information that you have. I mean, it was very, very knowledgeable. I didn't know half of what you talked about, and I'm sure it's going to give people, you know, grounds for further research. So thanks again for coming on, and thank you for your time, and we look forward to contributions from you and maybe having you back on again.
Well, that'd be great. We pretty much just scratched the surface of of, you know, what's really going on here with the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, I always encourage everyone to do their own research, and I'm by no means an expert. I've only known about this stuff for the last, you know, 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
One good resource that I would recommend to everybody is to look up H.R. 883, and that is the American Land Sovereignty Protection Act, which was introduced in 1999 by Congressman Ron Paul. And he's been one of, like, the only people in Congress to actually confront this issue head on. And you can read the transcript, and you can hear what he has to say, and some of the other congressmen, what they had to say about it, and judge for yourself.
Absolutely. And, yeah, Ron Paul's awesome. I'm voting for Ron Paul. I think I've made that clear. I actually shut down my site and put a big thing up saying that the reason I shut it down was because I was going to go work for Ron Paul. I'm getting him elected, so I don't think it's no secret. So I'll let everybody know.
I'm voting for Ron Paul, too, obviously. And when people ask me why, as the simple answer I give them, I say he's going to get us out of the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And that raises a bunch of questions for those people. So I can discuss this topic with them and hopefully get them more interested and have them do their own research.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a significant topic that a lot of people don't know anything about. And as we get into it, because I'm going to get, you know, right now I'm still in the, you know, the beginning I'm still kind of on the surface level of most of the stuff that we're getting into. But as time goes on, we're going to get into individualized information, you know, more specific stuff. And we'll definitely have you back on for those things to just go into details about, you know, the theories of land sovereignty, why that's an issue, just, you know, specific stuff related to the United Nations.
Well, great. I look forward to it. And as a final thought, just when people, if they decide to do their own research, just write this question down while you're researching it. And just, why is the UN dictating U.S. policy? Just keep that question in mind while you research.
That's the question. That's the question for, I think, a lot of what my podcast is about, is to try to get at why all these things are happening and why these agendas are being encouraged, and to see if they're harmful to us in any way. Well, thanks again, Chris. For your time, and I look forward to any posts that you put on there. That, once again, that's Bread and Circus. Is that
Circus
correct?
And Bread.
CircusandBread.com. I'm going to put that link on the website with this podcast, so you can all, if you forget what it is, you just feel free to come over to my site and link right over. He's got a lot of good stuff there. Okay, I'm going to end off this podcast now, but first, I'd like to thank Chris and for his time to come and share his knowledge, which I got to admit is very thick. I'm glad he's going to be contributing to the site. I had spoken with him about it before, and he agreed to contribute some stuff to the site, so that's great. It's good to have somebody on board with me who's going to do battle with these ideologies. The next thing I'd like to do before I go is I want to read a segment of a book by Zbigniew Brzezinski. I have such a hard time saying that, so forgive me. It's a book called Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. And it's a very interesting book. I mean, a lot of people read The Grand Chessboard, but this book, I think, really, really lays it out on what's going on in the world today with the people who are considered the hierarchy. And just to kind of go through a few things, it's divided into parts. So he has, the first part is the global impact of the technotronic revolution. And he talks about the age of technology and basically what it's doing to society. Part two, he goes into the age of volatile belief. And let me give you some of the things that it talks about. The quest for a universal vision, the universal religions, the national identity, and ideological universalism. Turbulence within institutionalized beliefs. He goes into Marxism and what that is. Escape from reason. Then in part three, communism, And he goes into a lot of detail about communism and how it's the future. Let's see. Actually, one part of it's called The Soviet Future. Part 4, The American Transition. The Third American Revolution. The Pace and Thrust of Progress. The New Left Reaction. And obviously he's referring to the left wing. And there's going to be a new left, I guess, or there already is. The Crisis of Liberalism. The End of Liberal Democracy. America and the World, The American Future. Participatory Pluralism, Change in Cultural Formation, Rational Humanism. These are all titles to chapters. And if you keep, the titles aren't revealing, I mean, this quote that I'm going to read is basically going to give it away. The Revolutionary Process, USA/USSR. Policy Implications, A Community of Developed Nations. And this is the part I'm going to read because it applies to what we've been talking about. A Community of Developed Nations. These more immediate necessary changes must be reinforced by a broader effort to contain the global tendencies toward chaos. A community of developed nations must eventually be formed if the world is to respond effectively to the increasing serious crisis that in different ways now threatens both the advanced world and the third world. Persistent divisions among the developed states, particularly those of outmoded ideological concepts, will negate the effort of individual states to aid the third world. In the more advanced world, they could even contribute to the reinsurgence of nationalism. And it goes on and on. I recommend that everybody get this book. Zygmunt Pachinski, look into who he is, his history with our government, and Rita's book, Between Two Ages, and the other one, The Grand Chessboard. If you really want to understand what's going on in Iraq and what's about to happen in Iran and every war we have with the Middle East in the future, you need to read that book. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and sign out. I have no idea what the next podcast is going to be about. I would really like to get an interview with the guy from Zeitgeist, but I really don't think it's going to happen at this point. I've sent him tons of emails. So other than that, I am now taking donations and welcoming advertisers on my site to help pay for it, because I want to be able to expand it and do a bunch of things, but I just don't have the cash for it myself. So if you have the kindness in your heart to donate, please do. And lastly, and very lastly, I'm going to give a shout out to my wife, because she asked me to do it. We're corny. Okay. Until next time.